Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning telephone talk show. My name is Jack Brighton, sitting in for David Inge. Glad you could listen. Our producers are Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal, and Jason Croft is at the control. Very glad you are listening. It's said that the first casualty of war is truth. Throw in an election year, and you've got some really interesting dilemmas for rhetoric and democracy. That is the topic for this hour of Focus 580. We'll talk about war rhetoric's toll on democracy. The title of a talk to be given by our guest at the University YMCA at noon, part of the Friday Forum Lecture Series. Bruce Williams is our guest. He is the director of the Institute of Communications Research at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, where he has taught for 10 years. He received his PhD in political science from the University of Minnesota and has taught at the Pennsylvania State University, the University of Michigan, and the London School of Economics. He's published 4 books and more than 50 scholarly journal articles and book chapters. Bruce's most recent book, Democracy, Dialogue, and Environmental Disputes, The Contested Languages of Social Regulation, co-authored with Albert Matheny, was published by Yale University Press, and it won the Caldwell Prize as the best book for 1996 from the Science, Technology, and Environmental Politics section of the American Political Science Association. He's also the editor, with Andrea Press, of the Communication Review. Bruce's current research interest focuses on the role of mass media in shaping citizenship, and he is currently completing a book with Michael X. Deli Carpini, tentatively entitled, And the Walls Came Tumbling Down, The Eroding Boundaries Between News and Entertainment and What They Mean for Mediated Politics in the 21st Century. We'll talk with Bruce Williams about a variety of issues, looking at the history of war rhetoric and what that means for the democratic process. And I'm sure we'll talk about current rhetoric and current events in American culture and politics during this hour. As we talk with Bruce Williams, we invite you into the conversation. All you have to do is pick up the telephone and call us, the number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line anywhere you hear us around the Midwest on air and on the Internet, anywhere in the continental U.S., toll-free 800-222-9455. I also, at the outset, before I forget, I want to mention that Bruce Williams will also be a guest on Bob McChesney's show, Media Matters, this Sunday at 1 o'clock, so you'll have a chance to hear him there as well. Professor Williams, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
Now, you have written an article, I think, for the Journal of Higher Education?
No, the Chronicle of Higher Education.
Thank you. Right. Yes. All right. Well, now, I'm forgive me, but I haven't read the article. but we talked briefly before the show, and you looked at some of the history of rhetoric, especially during World War I, as it relates to the war. And maybe we could start there.
Yeah, I was in London on sabbatical in the run-up to the invasion of Iraq. And in talking to a colleague there, I was reminded of the work of Harold Laswell, who went on to become one of the most influential political scientists of the 20th century. But it turns out that Laswell had written his PhD dissertation on analyzing the propaganda campaigns that were used during World War I by both the Allied and the Central Powers. And he published his book in 1927, and I actually went and read that book again. And it was, and it got me very interested in the history of propaganda, because when Laswell described the techniques that were used during World War I, they sounded eerily similar to the techniques that were used by both the Bush and Blair administrations to mobilize public opinion for war. One of the techniques, for example, that's familiar to us all right now is Laswell argued that if you wanted to mobilize popular support for a war, you had to make your message very, very simple. And he believed that successful propaganda needed to be based on these kind of simple ideas. And so one of the things he said is the idea of presenting a war as a conflict between two nations or two peoples was way too complicated, because the idea of a nation is complicated, the idea of the divisions within a nation becomes complicated. And so what he believed is what governments needed to do is have the enemy leader stand for the nation and then demonize that leader. And he meant demonization very, very literally. He believed that the enemy leader had to be portrayed as the devil himself and stand in for the nation. And so that's quite familiar to anyone who has lived through the rhetoric about Saddam Hussein. But if you look at what was said about Kaiser Wilhelm in the Allied press, it is very similar to what's said about Saddam Hussein. Another technique that Laswell identified is that you always needed to portray a war as defensive. Even if you were planning a complete sneak attack on an enemy, you had to sell that to your population as necessitated by the plans for the enemy to strike your country. And so it seems to me that if you think about it that way, that claims about weapons of mass destruction and the connection between Iraqi possession of weapons of mass destruction and the connection between Saddam Hussein and Osama bin Laden, both of which are claims which have been disproven by almost all dispassionate analyses and even the government's own analysis, those become linchpins of a propaganda campaign because they're central to the ability to portray what was an invasion of a sovereign country without UN backing as basically a defensive attack. We had to do it because they were getting ready to attack us. Indeed, they already had attacked us on 9/11. And I think that what this suggested to me is that while we think of ourselves today as relatively sophisticated media consumers, people who are able to resist the manipulations of government to mobilize public opinion, that in fact the techniques that are used by government today at the dawn of the 21st century are almost exactly the same as the techniques that were used by governments in the first couple of decades of the 20th century. And I think one of the things that's important is to revive this term propaganda. I think that we soften and divert attention to precisely what's going on when we use terms like spin or persuasion or public relations. I think we are getting a better handle on what it means to mobilize public opinion if we think in terms of propaganda.
That's an interesting point because, you know, we use the word spin, as you say. And we know that we're being spun when a pundit gets on, MSNBC or Fox News or at a press conference. There's a particular spin on, events that are going on. And we call it spin. But when the minute somebody says that's propaganda, people go, whoa. No need to get nasty.
Well, I think that that is something that diverts attention from precisely what's going on. Now I think it's important to understand that there are reasons that governments use fairly sophisticated propaganda techniques. And again, Laswell was someone who identified those terms. One of the things he said was that he argued was that war in the 20th century became total war. And what that meant was it was no longer something that was going to be fought by a volunteer army. It required the mobilization of a society's entire resources and economy. So you had to get all of the population behind the conflict. And that is quite difficult because what we know from now decades of social science research is that most people most of the time don't care very much about politics. They're not very interested in it. And that's certainly the case when it comes to international affairs. So if you are going to fight a war, part of the prerequisites for being able to do that in a time of total war is to mobilize the entire resources of the population. And I think that the question that then haunted intellectuals in the interwar period between World War I and World War II was what this meant for democracy, which I think is the question that confronts us now as we are in an election and one of the things that worries me about all of this is that I think we're in an election where because of wartime propaganda campaigns that still have an impact on public opinion, it becomes very difficult, even in an election campaign, to talk about some of the very central issues that confront us as a democratic society. And that clearly involves the war on terrorism and its connection or lack thereof to our occupation of Iraq.
We have a call to talk with. Let's include them in our conversation. And let me just reintroduce our guest. We're talking with Bruce Williams. He's director of the Institute of Communications Research at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. He'll be speaking at noon at the University YMCA Friday Forum on this topic, War Rhetoric's Toll on Democracy. And we're having a conversation along those lines this morning. If you'd like to join us, the number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll-free elsewhere, 800-222-9455. Listener in Champaign is first on line number one. Good morning.
Hi.
Mm-hmm. Good morning.
I'd like to see whether you could expand Laswell's categories, maybe some of his other categories regarding politics, who gets what, where, when, how, etc., and maybe talk about, one, the propaganda not only from the American government or the right wing, if we want to say it that way, but also talk about, use that analysis to look at the propaganda by the so-called Islamic terrorist, if we want to call him that, Osama bin Laden, etc., whether we could use it to help us understand both in American politics internally between the left and the right, both sides, whether we call it the demonization of George Bush, which is certainly goes on, or the demonization of others, even John Kerry's treatment by the Bush media and this morning by Bush's campaign spokesman on NPR. And then maybe we could also shift it back to the Middle East and talk about the demonization of Israel by those on the left and the attitude towards the Palestinians. So I would like you to, you know, use this paradigm or perspective and see if you could use it in a number of different areas. And I'll just hang up and listen to you. Does that sound clear, what I'm asking?
Yes, I think I
yeah, small question there.
Wait, yeah, right.
Go ahead.
Just to touch on a few of the points you made. First of all, I think one of the things that is absolutely spot on in what I think you're trying to get at is that Laswell believed that the only solution to propaganda in support of one set of policies was a propaganda campaign in support of another set of policies. He was fairly cynical about the abilities of ordinary citizens to understand, as was most of the mid-century empirical social science, for them to understand anything that's at all sophisticated about world politics. I think you're absolutely right that that these techniques are the reason they're used by both sides. The reason, and it's not just demonization. It is the idea both if we think about the arguments that come out of Islamic extremists. They are couched in exactly the same kind of techniques that Laswell identified. It's not just demonization. It is things like this being a very clear, crystal clear moral struggle between good and evil. Our president's rhetoric that either you are with us or you're with the terrorists is mirrored by the rhetoric of Islamic extremists who say that either you are with us or you are with the infidels who are against God. And that is connected to this idea of demonization, because as I said before, Laswell took this very seriously. Demonization is a call to see a conflict in crystal clear moral terms. I think that the issue that's troubling for me, and I think the caller is correct in identifying the different places in the world where these techniques are used. The question that preoccupies me right now is the same question that preoccupied mid-20th century intellectuals like Harold Laswell, like Walter Lippmann, like John Dewey. And that is, what is the connection between these very effective and widely used propaganda techniques and democracy? And I think that as we move into an election campaign, and we see, as the caller pointed out, the very same kind of brute, blunt propaganda techniques used by both sides, I think that it makes it very difficult, even in an election campaign, to have anything like a serious public debate about the important issues that confront us.
Mm-hmm. There's something in what you said that I wanted to follow up, and then we'll get on to some of the callers because we have several waiting. Further, the demonization of the opposition, whether it's a political candidate or, you know, Osama bin Laden or George Bush, as other people have remarked, in fact, we had a conversation with the last week's Friday Forum speaker on this issue, it makes negotiation impossible because what you essentially say is this the other side is evil, and there's no compromise with evil. You can't do that because the only way to win is complete annihilation of evil.
Well, I think that part of what troubles me about the use of these campaigns now is, and I want to go back to something I said about Laswell and his justification mm-hmm. for propaganda. Remember, he believed that the reason that these campaigns were needed is because we were talking about total war. Mm-hmm. The only mm-hmm. way you could fight World War I or World War II was through total mobilization. And it seems to me that fighting a Nazi Germany astride Western Europe with designs to conquer the entire world is a very different proposition than invading Iraq. And that does not call for, even as the president has tried to emphasize, this is not a conflict that is going to require total mobilization. It's being fought again by a volunteer army. It scarcely ripples through our everyday lives. It is a much more limited conflict. And I think the problem with using these blunt propaganda techniques is that strategically they are counterproductive. Because if, as you say, the conflict is between good and evil, there is no compromise. You have to wipe out evil. And that makes it very difficult to contemplate the kind of proportional responses, proportional military responses, or even non-military responses that might be most appropriate in what in the lingo now are called asymmetric conflicts. We are not fighting the war to end all wars. We are not fighting fascism.
We have a couple calls to talk with. Let's go next to a listener in Kentucky on line number 4. Good morning.
Yes. What scares me is with Mr. Alawi yesterday, everything, all of his problems seemed to be the media, and he kept blaming the media for everything, and all of his problems were because the media wasn't reporting and this and that, and I see that as a plan to try to suppress anything bad. In other words, so we're going to have to go to BBC or somewhere to get the true facts if he could have his way. What do you think?
I think that the role of the media is especially important when we think about how propaganda campaigns work today as opposed to the way they worked in the early part of the 20th century. One of the things that is clearly different between now and World War I and even World War II is that we have experienced over the last, let's say, 20 years, a communication revolution. It is almost impossible to keep your population insulated from information in the rest of the world that contradicts, argues with, refutes the kind of information that's coming from your own government. So you can click on the internet and search on a term like Iraq and get links to articles in the BBC, to Al Jazeera, to the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, to the United Nations. It is very easy to find information that contradicts the arguments that are being made by the government. And what I think happens then is that the propaganda campaigns, rather than really uniting a population in support of the policies that are adopted by the government, winds up increasingly polarizing the population, that you get people who either believe the government or don't believe the government. And I think that blaming the media in kind of the blunt way that both Alawi and our own president blames the media really obscures the complicated media environment in which we now live. And I think that that requires us to rethink the mobilization of public opinion for conflict.
Is the caller still there? I think they hung up, so I hope that gets at their question. Very good. We have a couple callers left, and we're almost in our midpoint. Our guest this morning is Bruce Williams. He's director of the Institute of Communications Research at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. And we're talking about war rhetoric and its toll on democracy, the subject of his speech at the University YMCA Friday Forum at noon today. The University Y is at 1001 South Wright Street in Champaign, just on the Champaign side of Wright Street. And that's free and open to the public if you'd like to attend. Meanwhile, we have a couple callers and time for others if you'd like to join us. The number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll-free elsewhere, 800-222-9455. We'll go next to a listener in Normal on line number one. Good morning. Is there a caller there?
Yeah, I'm on the line.
Okay, good.
Okay, I didn't know you were talking to me.
Okay.
Okay, this may have been partially an overlap here with the last question, but I'm curious about the media and what propaganda needs media to carry out its message. So I'm wondering about what the role is, what the role can be, should be of media. And also, historically, I'm wondering, you know, we tend actually to demonize our media, if you want to talk about demonizing. And I'm wondering, you know, historically, have things always been the same as they are now, or have there been some differences? And I'll hang up.
Okay. Thanks for the call.
I think that's a great question, and I'm not sure I can fully answer it. It's what I spend a lot of my time thinking about and trying to understand. I think that one of the things that I'd like to that it's important to make a distinction about is the media versus the press or journalism. And one of the problems of journalism, I believe, and this is something that is fairly constant. That goes back certainly to Laswell's calculations about propaganda before World War I, is that in the run-up to war, in propaganda campaigns that are designed to mobilize public opinion, journalists, the press, newspapers in Laswell's time now, television journalism, print journalism, they play a critical role because most analyses of press coverage of even the most recent run-up to war, paints a picture of journalists that really don't behave in the run-up to war the way they do when they cover other issues. They basically pass on, with very little criticism, the claims of their own government without the kind of two sides to every story, the idea that they're supposed to be disinterested in the passing on of information. And so the very same people that we rely on in ordinary times, if I can call them ordinary times, to provide us with a kind of digested and analyzed view of what the government is saying, they play a very different role. They become mouthpieces for the state. And I think that that is something that is that still goes on today. And I'm not just kind of making wild accusations. The Program for International Political Attitudes at the University of Maryland has done a lot of polling on just this topic, where people get information about the conflict in Iraq, what they believe about it, and they did about a year ago a poll where they looked at three misconceptions about the war. The first was that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction and that they were found. The second is that there was a clear connection between Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda on the one hand and Saddam Hussein in Iraq on the other. And third, that most other countries in the world, either the population supported the invasion of Iraq or they were evenly divided. Now, those are three misperceptions. Those are not true. But it turns out that they found that, for example, they looked at where people got their information from. And they found, and it's probably no surprise to anyone here, that 80% of the people who relied primarily on Fox News for their information believed at least one of these misperceptions. What's a little more surprising, given the flap over CBS News the last few days, is that over 70% of the people who relied on CBS News believed one of these misperceptions. And not to pat Jack and his colleagues too much on the back, but it turns out that people who relied on NPR or PBS for their news were only about a quarter of them, about 23% believed one of these misperceptions.
Which is still scary.
It is still scary because the belief in these misperceptions is an important part of support for the war. It turns out that if you believe all three of these misperceptions, people who have all three of those misperceptions, 86% of them supported the war.
Yeah.
And I think that so on the one hand, I think that Laswell's framework gives us a good handle on how to think about the press and journalism in the mobilization for war, in propaganda campaigns. What has changed is that there is a whole lot of media that allows us to get a different perspective. And it's not just the internet. It's things like The Daily Show.
I was just going to say The Daily Show.
Yes, it is things like the movie Fahrenheit 9/11 or even farther afield, The Manchurian Candidate. So I think that the way political information comes at us is so much more diverse that we need to think seriously about the difference between the media writ mm-hmm. large and the press or journalism.
Yeah. Well, just speaking about The Daily Show, which is one of my favorite TV shows, it's actually – I mean, they, you know, Jon Stewart is a gifted man, but he – makes the claim, and I think, you know, it's correct, it's a fake news show. I mean, it's not the real thing, folks. You know, he says don't take it so seriously. On the other hand, he does things on that show, you know, speaking of this issue of confusion, of these myths that, you know, Iraq had weapons of mass destruction, that there was a direct connect between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda, that so many Americans, I mean, some still hold those myths. And maybe that's a diminishing number, one hopes, because of all the coverage of the fact that they were myths. But nonetheless, it seems that many of the statements by the administration have, I'm not sure intentionally, I don't want to make that claim, but clouded those particular issues. And the media has failed largely to demonstrate that that those issues have been clouded. An example, on The Daily Show, Jon Stewart showed a clip of Dick Cheney being interviewed by one of the major television news programs in which he said, and this was a recent interview, I don't understand how people could have got confused that there was a direct working relationship, that there was direct connection between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda. And the interviewer said, but you said a few months ago that we had clear evidence of a working relationship. And Dick Cheney said, no, I never said that. I never said that. And then Jon Stewart said, oh, really? And then he played a clip from the same interview program, Dick Cheney with the same interviewer, in which Cheney said, we have clear evidence of a connection between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda. No one else is revealing that and just showing that the statements we never said that, are just false.
Well, I think that's a great point. Indeed, the book that I'm working on with my colleague Michael Della Carpini really tries to come to grips with the what we would argue is the collapse of any distinction between news and entertainment or other kinds of media. I think that we live, as I've been saying, in a very different media environment, which changes the role of journalism. I am not one of those people that castigate young people for relying on The Daily Show. I think I watch The Daily Show all the time, and I could not agree with you more that, I think that Jon Stewart is being coy. I think that he's playing his cards very close to the vest because he has to when he talks about his role in public debate. On the other hand, he is incredibly critical of journalism for just the reasons you are pointing to, is that the role of, you know, in journalism being objective, whereas Fox would say being fair and balanced, mm-hmm. does not mean that you simply let someone from one position scream at someone from the other position and stay out of it. Mm-hmm. There are certain sort of, dare we say, facts or truths that journalists ought to bring to the fore. And I think that to the extent they don't, it is important that there are other sources of information that really do that.
We have several calls. Let's go on and talk with our next listener, someone in Eureka, on line number two. Good morning.
Woe to the liberal NPR. Thank you for your timely program this morning. What I would like to ask your comment on is some of the comments of the vice president have deeply, deeply troubled me, which to me is propaganda, when I think he says something to the effect that if Senator Kerry is elected, the United States is really going to get hit by Al-Qaeda. Could you comment on this, please?
Yes, I think that is part of really what troubles me most about the continuation of wartime rhetoric and wartime propaganda in basically an open-ended fashion that moves over into the election campaign. I think that there is a reason that the Bush administration, makes these sly claims. They make them and then they pull them back about what would happen if the connection between a Kerry victory and a terrorist attack. Because if you go back to this public perceptions of international politics, I'm mixing up the name, but we all call it the PIPA poll from the University of Maryland. Among those who perceived experts as saying Iraq had weapons of mass destruction, again, that's not true. But of those who believed that was true, 72% said they would vote for Bush, and 23% said they would vote for Kerry. Among those who perceived experts as concluding that Iraq did not have weapons of mass destruction, which is what almost everyone concluded, 23% said they'd vote for Bush and 74% for Kerry. And it's similar when you look at that connection between Osama bin Laden and Saddam Hussein. The more you believe that, the more likely you are to vote for Bush and the less likely you are to vote for Kerry. So I think that this is part of the election campaign. And what troubles me is that when you have in an election campaign the patriotism of your opponent being called into question, or the idea that we can't criticize the incumbent because this is wartime, that really makes me worried for the state of democracy.
I like the term words of mass deception because yeah. That's exactly what I think we're getting from the current administration. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
You're
for
welcome.
Several callers waiting. We'll go on next to a listener in Mattoon on line number four. Good morning.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
You're talking about three myths that have been propagated. Apparently, you don't classify the use of gas against the Kurds as the use of weapons of mass destruction.
I think that is an interesting point. And I think that it goes back to something that Laswell observed about propaganda campaigns in World War I. If you look at the atrocity stories that were leveled against the German army when they marched through Belgium, even the very worst, the most, it seemed outrageous propaganda stories had a core of truth to them if you looked very deeply. I think that the question of the use of gas against the Kurds is, I think, strikes at what we mean by weapons of mass destruction. The reason, if you go back to the arguments that were made by the administration justifying the war, the invasion of Iraq, it's that weapons, and again, weapons of mass destruction is a term of art. It's a term of propaganda, because if you look at where that term comes from and the images and emotions that it calls up, the weapons of mass destruction that we worry about are nuclear weapons. Those are the ultimate weapons of mass destruction. I think the reason we get so worried about those weapons is because they pose a threat to us. That is the linchpin of mobilization for a war like this. That we are invading this country because if we don't do that, they're going to invade us. They are going to attack us, and that's why weapons of mass destruction are such an important part of the propaganda campaign. I think as horrible as the use of poison gas is in any context, the question of whether that poses a threat to the United States is a very, very different question.
So, in fact, I think the United Nations viewed gas and the use of gas as weapons of mass destruction, and in fact they had used them. So, in fact, it is true that they did have, at least at some point, weapons of mass destruction. That, in fact, is not a myth.
Well, I think
the Iraqi troops were carrying gas masks, weren't they?
Well, I think, first of all, I think the key question there is at some point, because the use of gas against the Kurds when would that have been?
Iran-Iraq War, 1989, 1990.
The question of what the Iraqis had when we invaded them and whether they were complying with UN mandates to destroy their stockpiles of weapons of mass destruction. No one argues whether they had them 10 or 15 years ago. That is not the question. That's not the misperception, and let me get the exact wording that the PIPA poll used. The misperception was, and this is the quote, U.S. forces found weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. So the claim and the misperception is not that they at some point in the past had them. The claim and the misperception is that they had them when we invaded them. And I think the experts are pretty uniform that was not the case.
Hope that gets at the caller's question. We have several callers remaining, and we'll go next to someone in Belgium, forgive me, on line number 3. Go ahead.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
The point that needs to be observed now or taken into account now is that we've got to get out of this situation. Someplace along the line, we've got to get out of it. Now, there's various types of wars that we've fought in the past. Some have been fought over women, the Trojan War. But the Second World War was fought over a war of conquest where people went out and grabbed land. The Cold War was a war of ideology, which Vietnam and Korea were just two hot spots about. And the way we defeated the German and Japanese armies to get them done by just taking back the ground. The Cold War, we just essentially spent them into the ground. They couldn't keep up with us. This war we're dealing with is a cultural war, and that one's going to be very, very difficult to deal with. The problems in Israel and Palestine and throughout the whole area there is a cultural war, which is going to be very, very, very difficult for us to find a way to defeat it.
I think that's an important observation, and if I can go back to some of the problems with using what are fairly blunt propaganda techniques, one of the problems with using this idea of demonization, I think we see it now, is that if the conflict is between us and an evil leader, the devil, when that leader is either killed or captured, that ought to end the problem. And it is extremely difficult when you've built a case for war on this idea of these very blunt black and white moral questions that we are, it's a battle of good against evil. It is very difficult when we capture Saddam Hussein, when we get rid of the evil leader, to then explain to the public the problems that we encounter when we try and reconstruct and democratize a shattered society. And it's and the problems that we face here are exactly the same problems that Allied powers had at the end of World War I, when they had gotten rid of the Kaiser. Germany had been defeated, but then there were enormous problems in how to reconstruct German society. And one of the real, lessons, if you come leery of lessons from history, but I think one of the things we ought to pay attention to is that the problems of constructing a just and lasting peace after World War I were not addressed and not solved. And one of the lasting impacts of the victory in World War I was the carnage of World War II. And I think that if we are engaged in a cultural battle, if the problems in the Middle East are very complicated because they do involve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, they do involve questions of oil, they do involve questions of our allies being authoritarian regimes, and what does that mean when we go to war to create a democracy in the Middle East? What is the real nature of the conflict between Shia and Sunnis in Iraq? Where do the Kurds figure in all of this? What constitutes the nation of Iraq? All of those are important, complex questions that we could be debating at some level. But when you portray the war the way it gets portrayed in these propaganda campaigns, it makes it very difficult, if not impossible, to have those kinds of debates.
Thank you very much, sir.
You're welcome.
Thanks for the call. Well, you know, it strikes me, and we have another call I'll get right to, but just a quick follow-up, that we're still fighting the propaganda war over Vietnam.
I could not agree more. And obviously, because this is radio, listeners can't see how old I am, but I am 52, and I am of the Vietnam War generation. And I believe that there are important parallels between U.S. involvement in Vietnam and U.S. involvement in Iraq. I think that at the very least, that is an important question. To the extent that those issues get cast in the terms that they have been cast, and here I fault the Kerry campaign no less than the Bush campaign, to the extent they get cast around questions of who is more macho, who was braver, who really got wounded, who really bled, who ran away, that obscures our ability to really talk about what I think was a profoundly brave action by John Kerry, which is he fought in the war, he volunteered for the war, he came back and he criticized the war. He had seen it. And I think that a lot of the reasons that he criticized the war in Vietnam are, it would be interesting to be able to talk about them today as we get sucked further and further into a situation of chaos and violence in Iraq.
Mm-hmm. We have just about 10 minutes left with our guest, maybe a little bit less. Bruce Williams, Director of the Institute of Communications Research at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. He'll be speaking at the University YMCA Friday Forum lecture at noon today. If you'd like to attend that, you're welcome to do so. It's free and open to the public. And if you'd like to join us in the time remaining, our lines are open now. The local line, 333-9455. Toll free elsewhere, 800-222-9455. I think another thing that struck me about the rhetoric surrounding the campaign and the role of the media in this is there seems to be a sort of strange dysfunction going on in the media that the media is fully aware of but can't seem to do anything about. And a good example is the whole uproar over the document used by Dan Rather detailing Bush's service in the National Guard. And the story then became the document and Dan Rather and CBS. And you know, I'm watching all these news programs cover this over and over and over again, and part of the coverage of the story is how we're spending too much time covering the story, and we'll be back right after this message, and we'll continue talking about this.
I think that that gets to some of the changes that have occurred in the nature of both the way journalism comes at us and the nature of the media environment. One of the things that I've been trying to argue is that, for better or worse, when you had propaganda campaigns from the beginning to the last quarter of the 20th century, they were in the context of a media system where political information was coming to us from a very limited number of sources. In the 1950s, for example, through the early 1980s, there were three network news broadcasts. That was all that was on, basically, and, you know, fantastic percentages of everyone with a TV set were watching one of those three broadcasts. And that was pretty much it for where most people, maybe really motivated people, would also read a newspaper. But almost all of the political information that was coming at us was from journalists. And journalists have a particular way of covering those issues. I mean, that's why they are professional journalists. And they get criticized a lot. I've just criticized them for the way they behave in war, in the run-up to war, but they behave in a certain way. Now we have a very different system. The audience for the nightly news broadcast is way down, and people are watching Fox, CNN, small numbers, but there's still over a million people watch Fox every day. They're watching The Daily Show. They're cruising the internet. They're getting information from a lot of different places. And that leads to a fragmented and polarized public. And when you wage these kind of propaganda campaigns, it polarizes the public even more. And I watch Fox News a lot. And I think there was a thinly disguised glee that CBS News had been caught. And this meant the end of, you know, the dominance of the network news. Well, I think that dominance is long over, and Fox is one of the major beneficiaries of it.
We have several callers. We'll try to get as many as we can before we run out of time. We'll go next to someone on a cell phone on line number one. Good morning. Hello?
Yeah, hello?
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to get a reaction from you on a thought I have. The Bush campaign indicates that they need to be reelected because we're in a war. They also indicate that this war is not a traditional war and may go on for 10, 20 years. So I'm wondering if in a few years they're not going to be talking about getting rid of the two-term limits on the presidency. And I was wondering if you could just talk about that.
I think that, given the nature of our political system, that would be a pretty difficult thing to do. But, and I'm not, you know, maybe I should worry about it, but I have other bigger fish to fry right now, I guess. But I think the initial point you made is what to me is alarming. Mm-hmm. It is this idea that we are fighting a war which basically has no end to it. Mm-hmm. There is it morphs very seamlessly from Al-Qaeda to Iraq. And when you have a war that really is ill-defined in terms of what would be its end point, the thing that really frightens me is that then that gives warrant to elites to use the same, you know, continuously this kind of wartime propaganda techniques that are then taken up by segments of the press. And I think that's something worth worrying about.
Well, they're also taken up by other governments, for example, Vladimir Putin in Russia. I mean, you know, that's a very complicated situation, but, you know, he is battling a war on terrorism as well. And that kind of situation may justify taking certain actions, which in recent days we've seen Putin say that he's going to now appoint leaders in the 89 provinces in the Russian Federation. And certainly in one view, you could say that's a rollback of democracy. And certainly in other areas, in Indonesia, in Israel, in so many other places, the war on terror can justify so many other things.
Well, I think that goes back to something that several callers have brought up and that we've been talking about for a while. And I don't know enough about the situation in Russia to comment intelligently about it. But from the perspective of the United States, I think, again, what is troubling is that to the extent that this propaganda rhetoric dominates our political discourse, then it puts us in a very difficult position when it comes to dealing with someone like Vladimir Putin. How do you tell him not to crack down on what we, centralize power, when that is a large part of what the government is doing in the United States? Now, I'm not saying that American democracy is in any way parallel to the situation of the attempt to establish democracy in Russia. What I'm arguing is that the rhetoric of war and the way it's been deployed makes it very difficult to address in anything like a subtle way our relationship to Russia or other and the obvious example is Pakistan. So I think that is a problem that is inherent in the use of these propaganda campaigns.
We're just about out of time, and I'm sorry there's a couple of callers we simply won't be able to take. There's much more we could talk about on this topic, and I certainly hope we will continue the conversation in programs in the days ahead. But let me also mention again that our guest, Bruce Williams, will be speaking at the University YMCA in just about an hour at noon, the University Y Friday Forum Series. That's at 1001 South Wright Street. That's free and open to the public. They have a great Thai restaurant there, by the way.
Yes, I know.
And so he'll be speaking more on this topic there. Also, he'll be the guest on Bob McChesney's Media Matters this Sunday from 1 to 2 p.m. here on WILL AM 580. And I also wanted to mention, which I did not before, that Bob McChesney will also be speaking at the University YMCA next Tuesday in the Know Your University Lecture Series. He'll be speaking on his book, The Problem of the Media and Media Politics in 2004 and Beyond. That's also at noon, free and open to the public at the University Y. And today, Bruce Williams will speak there. Thank you so much for being here.
You're very welcome.